Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, we continue our preview of the upcoming 2017 term, looking at three immigration-related cases on the court's docket. On June 26th, the last opinion day of the term, the court announced that it would not be issuing decisions in two of that term's cases, but they would instead be re-argued in the coming October 2017 term. The two cases, Sessions v. DiMaia and Jennings v. Rodriguez, were both immigration law cases that were argued to an 8-member court before Justice Gorsuch's confirmation. The court didn't officially explain why it was having the cases re-argued, but the near-universal assumption among court watchers was that this was because the court was deadlocked 4-4. Re-argument in front of the now 9-member court would enable the court to successfully count to 5, perhaps with Gorsuch casting the tie-breaking vote if the other justices remained evenly divided. In a July speech at Duke University School of Law, Justice Ginsburg gave some support to the deadlock explanation, suggesting that the re-argument was necessary because the court was short-staffed. Here's Ginsburg.
Two cases from the 2016 to 2017 term will be re-argued next term before a full bench of 9 members.
And later?
8 is not a good number for a collegial court. And we did try hard to avoid 4-4 splits. And we were not totally successful. I mentioned two cases that have been set down for re-argument next term. But I think that speaks rather well for the court that we were able to agree so much more often than we disagreed sharply.
In a few minutes, we'll take a look at each of these returning cases. But first, I want to look at the third immigration case on the court's docket. It's a politically controversial issue that's been all over the news and actively litigated for the past 6 months, and potentially the highest profile case of the coming Supreme Court term. That's the litigation over President Trump's immigration executive orders, often referred to as the travel ban. The travel ban litigation is complicated, with a huge number of moving parts. There are numerous separate lawsuits challenging various parts of the executive order and multiple different legal theories drawing on controversial and unsettled areas of the law. There's enough going on here to easily justify multiple hours of in-depth analysis, but for the purposes of this episode, I'm just going to sketch out the litigation in general terms, highlighting some of the most important issues in play. First, let's quickly look at where this litigation came from and how it got to the Supreme Court. On January 27th, only a week after taking office, President Trump issued Executive Order 13769, which, among other things, imposed a 90-day bar on entry into the United States for nationals of 7 countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. According to the executive order, this 90-day entry ban is supposed to facilitate an internal review of the government's visa adjudication practices. The executive order also suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program for 120 days and lowered the annual cap on total refugees. The order immediately led to chaos and confusion at international airports around the country because the entry ban applied even to persons who had already been issued a visa to visit the United States, including some who were in the air en route to the U.S. at the time the order issued. The initial implementation of the order was widely criticized as incompetent. For example, the Trump administration first stated that the entry ban applied to lawful permanent residents, green card holders, before backtracking a day later and stating that green card holders would not be excluded. Similarly, the State Department initially said that the entry ban applied to dual citizens of a restricted and non-restricted country, only to reverse position several days later, saying that dual citizens could be admitted under a passport from the unrestricted country. Shortly after the executive order issued, literally dozens of legal challenges were filed in courts across the country challenging some or all of the executive order on various legal grounds. Most of these lawsuits sought preliminary injunctions against enforcement of the executive order. That is, they asked the courts for immediate orders prohibiting the federal government from implementing the travel ban. In the days immediately after the executive order, federal judges in New York and Massachusetts issued limited injunctions against portions of the travel ban. But the first major roadblock to the executive order came on February 3rd in a case called State of Washington v. Trump, when a federal district judge in the Western District of Washington issued a nationwide injunction against the enforcement of the travel ban. The federal government immediately asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to stay the injunction, that is, prevent it from going into effect. A 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit held an expedited hearing on the case and issued a decision only days later on February 9th, refusing to lift the injunction. the Ninth Circuit's decision relied largely on arguments that the travel ban executive order's lack of procedural protections, particularly for lawful permanent residents and visa holders, amounted to a denial of due process. After this decision, the Trump administration announced that it intended to issue a revised executive order that would address issues that had arisen in litigation. On March 6th, President Trump issued Executive Order 13780, which superseded the first executive order. This revised travel ban differed from the original in several ways, including removing Iraq from the list of restricted countries, exempting those who had already obtained valid visas prior to the order going into effect, and explicitly excluding green card holders from the entry ban, among other changes. The second order also had a 10-day delay before taking effect, which prevented a repeat of the airport chaos seen after the first order. Immediately after the issuance of the new executive order, challengers to the travel ban began amending their legal filings to address the revised version. The state of Hawaii was first out of the gate, filing an amended complaint and request for an injunction the very next day in their case State of Hawaii v. Trump, filed in the District of Hawaii. On March 15th, the day before the new travel ban was set to take effect, the federal district judge in Hawaii v. Trump issued a nationwide injunction blocking the travel ban. The following day, a federal judge in the District of Maryland issued a similar injunction in the case International Refugee Assistance Project, or IRAP, v. Trump. The Trump administration appealed both of these injunctions to the Ninth Circuit for the Hawaii case and to the Fourth Circuit for the IRAP case out of Maryland. On May 25th, the Fourth Circuit issued its opinion in IRAP v. Trump, upholding the district court's injunction. The Fourth Circuit held, relying extensively on President Trump's public statements during and after the presidential campaign, that the entry ban violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment because it had the effect of discriminating against Muslims and was motivated by anti-Muslim animus. A week later, on June 1st, the Trump administration petitioned the Supreme Court to hear the case and requested a stay of the Maryland District Court's injunction. The same day, Trump asked the Supreme Court for a stay of the Hawaii injunction, pending the Ninth Circuit's decision. On June 12th, the Ninth Circuit issued its decision in Hawaii v. Trump, like the Fourth Circuit, upholding the injunction. Unlike the Fourth Circuit, however, the Ninth Circuit didn't address the constitutional claims under the Establishment Clause. The Ninth Circuit instead rested its opinion on a statutory argument that the travel ban executive order exceeded the president's authority to restrict entry into the U.S. under the immigration statutes. On June 26th, the last opinion day of the term, the Supreme Court ruled on the stay requests in the Hawaii and IRAP cases. In an unsigned opinion, the court stayed the lower court injunctions in part. The court allowed the injunctions to remain in place for entrants and refugees with a, quote, credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. So those persons with a genuine connection to the United States can continue to enter the country as before the executive order. But for those persons without such a bona fide relationship, the injunction was stayed. That is, the executive order goes into effect and they can be barred from entering the country. Both supporters and opponents of the travel ban quickly claimed this decision as a victory. At the same time that it ruled on the stay requests, the court also granted certiorari on the IRAP and Hawaii cases and announced that they would be argued during the first sitting of October term 2017. They were subsequently scheduled for oral argument on October 10th. The two cases are consolidated, meaning they will be argued and likely decided together as a single case. From here on out, they will typically be referred to collectively as Trump v. IRAP, because that was the first of the two to be filed with the court. Both the constitutional and statutory issues are before the court, but there's another issue that might get in the way of a decision: mootness. If you listened to episode 6 of this podcast, where we discussed Ivy v. Marath, a case the court dismissed as moot, you may remember that a case is moot when circumstances change so that a once legitimate controversy between the parties no longer exists. How does this apply here? By the terms of the executive order, the entry ban is explicitly temporary, running for 90 days from the effective date of the order. A subsequent memorandum from President Trump indicated that the 90-day clock would not begin to run for any enjoined provision until the injunction was lifted or stayed. In the Supreme Court's June 26th opinion, it suggested that its partial stay of the lower court injunctions triggered the start of the 90-day period. This means that the entry ban would expire in late September, about 2 weeks before the case is due to be argued. With no ban in place, the dispute would arguably be moot. But all of this depends on what happens between now and October. For example, the Trump administration could conceivably announce that it needs more time to conduct its internal review and therefore extend the entry ban for an additional period of time. Or the administration could announce that after completing its internal review, it concluded that the entry ban, or certain parts of it, would be made permanent. But even if the ban is allowed to expire, that might not be the end. There's an exception to mootness called the voluntary cessation doctrine, which says that if a case becomes moot only because a party voluntarily stopped engaging in the challenged conduct but would be free to resume it after the case is dismissed, then the case can still be heard. This exception is intended to prevent a party from using mootness opportunistically to avoid judicial oversight. Here, if the ban expires and the administration's policy going forward is still unsettled, challengers might argue that there's a reasonable possibility that the ban might be reinstated. At this point, it's very hard to guess how the mootness issue will play out, but a key factor to watch is how the Trump administration deals with the entry ban's expiration in late September.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
Now let's turn to the two immigration cases held over from last term. The first case, Sessions v. DiMaia, involves the standards for determining which crimes by legal immigrants justify removal from the United States. The Sessions in the case name is Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has a long history as an immigration hardliner. But in its first appearance before the Supreme Court, the case was known as Lynch v. DiMaia, after then-AG Loretta Lynch. By historical standards, the Obama administration was extremely aggressive about removing immigrants convicted of felonies. And on more than one occasion, the Supreme Court ruled against attempts by the Obama administration to remove immigrants convicted of relatively minor offenses. Although the Trump election has led to changes in the official government position in several Supreme Court cases, here, there is continuity from Obama to Trump. To understand this case, you need to know about an earlier case called Johnson v. United States, decided by the Supreme Court in 2015. Johnson was a case about the Armed Career Criminal Act, which imposed a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence on anyone convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm who has three or more convictions for a violent felony or serious drug offense. What counts as a violent felony? Violent felony was defined in the statute to include certain named crimes like burglary and arson, but also included any crime punishable by more than a year in prison that, quote, otherwise involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. This serious potential risk of physical injury provision is known as the residual clause, and the courts had repeatedly struggled to apply it. Before Johnson, the Supreme Court had decided four separate cases deciding whether a particular crime qualified as a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act, but its decisions provided little clear guidance for the lower courts. Finally, in Johnson, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, the court held that the residual clause was unconstitutionally vague, describing both the theoretical difficulties that the court had had in developing a workable standard for what crimes qualify as violent felonies, and the practical difficulties experienced by the lower courts. So what does this have to do with immigration law? Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, any alien convicted of an aggravated felony can be removed from the United States. The statute defines aggravated felony to include a, quote, crime of violence as defined in another statute. And that statute defines crime of violence to include any, quote, offense that is a felony and that by its nature involves a substantial risk that physical force against the person or property of another may be used in the course of committing the offense. James Garcia DiMaia, originally from the Philippines, is a lawful permanent resident of the U.S. DiMaia was convicted twice of residential burglaries, and the U.S. initiated removal proceedings on the grounds that his burglary convictions were aggravated felonies allowing removal, because burglary involves a substantial risk that physical force against the person or property of another may be used in the course of committing the offense. DiMaia argues that the substantial risk of physical force provision is unconstitutionally vague, just like the serious potential risk of physical injury clause of the Armed Career Criminals Act that the Supreme Court found unconstitutionally vague in Johnson. The government distinguishes this case from Johnson in two ways. First, the government argues that the vagueness standard applied in criminal cases doesn't apply in a civil context like removal proceedings. And second, the government focuses on differences between the specific language at issue here and the language of the Armed Career Criminals Act. The government argues, for example, that a risk of physical force is easier to determine than a risk of physical injury, and that the statute's limitation to force used, quote, in the course of committing the offense, clarifies the scope of the covered crimes. This case was argued before the court on January 17th, when the court was still operating with only eight justices, and the justices appeared to be divided on the question of whether the provision was unconstitutionally vague. On June 26th, when the court issued its final decisions of the term, it announced that Sessions v. DiMaia would be set for re-argument. This case has been scheduled for re-argument on Monday, October 2nd, the first day of the new October term 2017.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
The second held-over immigration-related case is Jennings v. Rodriguez. It revolves around the detention of aliens who are challenging their removal from the country, and specifically, whether they have a right to be free on bond pending a determination on their right to remain in the United States. The Rodriguez in the case name is Alejandro Rodriguez, a lawful permanent resident who first came to the United States as an infant. In 2003, Rodriguez was convicted of a minor drug charge and sentenced to probation, but on the basis of an earlier conviction for joyriding, that is, driving a stolen automobile, he was ordered removed from the country. He challenged his removal, and eventually, after an intervening Supreme Court decision in another case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded that driving a stolen vehicle was not a removable offense. In the meantime, however, Rodriguez spent more than 3 years in immigrant detention. Rodriguez and several other non-citizens who experienced lengthy immigration detentions brought this case as a class action on behalf of other similarly situated non-citizen detainees, alleging that they had a right to a bond hearing to determine whether they could be released pending a final decision in their removal proceedings. Some of the class members, like Rodriguez, are lawful permanent residents facing removal due to a criminal conviction. But others were denied entry at the border and are detained while they challenge their exclusion, for example, because a claim for asylum was allegedly wrongfully denied. The defendants in the case are a number of federal and local officials involved in the immigration detention system, including David Jennings, the field office director of the Los Angeles District of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who is the Jennings in Jennings v. Rodriguez. As originally argued to the court, this case was primarily about statutory interpretation. The detainees argued that the immigration provisions at issue could and should be construed to allow a bond hearing after 6 months of detention. But a few weeks after the November 30th oral argument, the court directed the parties to submit supplemental briefs, treating it instead as an issue of constitutional law, whether the Constitution requires a bond hearing before detaining an alien for an extended period of time. But like in DiMaia, on June 26th, the court announced that Jennings v. Rodriguez would be set for re-argument. This case has been scheduled for Tuesday, October 3rd, the second day of the new term.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
And that brings us to the end of Episode 14. But we're not done with Jennings v. Rodriguez. In the next episode, I'm going to bring you an interview with Ahilan Arulananthem, an attorney with the ACLU of Southern California, who represents the respondents in this case, that is, Rodriguez and the class of non-citizen detainees. He argued the case at the court last year, and he'll be back for the re-argument on October 3rd. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave comments and questions on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at Counting to 5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. Your feedback helps to shape future episodes. Let us know if you have questions about this or any other episode, and tell us if there are particular cases or issues that you want to hear more about. Please be sure to subscribe to Counting to 5 to make sure you don't miss future episodes. And if Counting to 5 isn't available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Finally, consider supporting us financially. Go to Counting to 5's Patreon page at patreon.com/countingto5, where you can make a monthly pledge in any amount as low as $1. Patrons have access to exclusive rewards, including special mini-explainer episodes, live video chats, bonus audio content, and more. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.